many of you here are pretty stressed right now?
Right now, or
in the last week, let's say. How many of you are not? Are pretty chilled out in the last week? I guess some of you are kind of in between the chilled out and the stress. How many of you would like to learn to manage stress better? I'm in the right place then. Just checking. Welcome to Fighting Stress, a Unibuzz event. When Kendrick wrote to me a few months back, we were saying, can you do this date or not? And there were a few possibilities, or maybe this date, maybe that date. So there was supposedly an earlier talk that I could have potentially done. Then I asked Kendrick what was the topic then. It was a different one. I said, why not if I move it later, I can do a later talk, which is today. And then I said, what topic then? And then this one came out, fighting stress. And when I came today, I asked what week this is for University of New South Wales. And then I was told it's week 12, is that correct? Yeah. And then I said, ah, that's right. Thank you for taking the time to come. I know that it is sometimes difficult to find time even to attend something like this, and especially tonight it's particularly challenging. I parked my car about 10 minutes away. I was walking here, so it's freezing. And I would think that a few people kind of put on their jacket and go outside. Whoa, maybe stay indoors. But you clearly decided to come here, and I do want to acknowledge you for taking the time to be here. And I hope that tonight's material, I will try to do my best to make it worthwhile for you to be here. So what essentially we are wanting to cover this evening is looking at Buddhist-based practices in terms of managing stress. And hopefully by the end of this evening, you'll walk away with one or two things that you can start using in your day-to-day life. Because you can always just talk, but if there's nothing much that you can use, then there's really no point. So hopefully by the end of the evening, you'll have an opportunity to gain something useful. A bit about my own background. I'm working as a clinical psychologist, so I do have a practice and it's based in Glee. So I see different people, adults, I don't see children, but all adults. One difficulty or another, depression, anxiety, stress, early on, someone asked me, how have you been? I say, I've been very busy. And then I say, business is expanding. Which means there's a lot of pain and suffering out there. There's a lot of people in distress. So that's my key work that I do. And my other role is working with University of Sydney's Counselling and Psychological Services, which you also have in your university. I used to be a counsellor there as well, but I've switched my focus now. Again, I used to see a lot of students. Around this period, the bookings are like full bookings. If someone cancels, immediately another booking comes. There's a lot of need for that support for students, so I understand where you are right now. My role right now is to look at research and program development for Sydney University's Counselling and Psychological Services. And one of the research that we've recently done is to ask the entire university student, postgraduate, undergraduate, whether international or local student, how are you doing? And how are you coping? Are you distressed? Are you feeling pretty okay? And it came back, and I think this will be across the board in different universities, about 20% or one-fifth of students are reporting levels of psychological distress that can be considered clinically significant. This means these are very distressed people. One-fifth of the population. So if I take, let's say, this room here, how many will be here roughly? Estimate. 30, 40? So about 8 of you or so will be considered significantly distressed. Or maybe the ones who manage to get here are pretty alright. But just giving you an idea of how serious this is. And this is across the board, I believe, in Australian universities. So clearly there's a lot of pain and difficulty that's happening out there. And a lot of my work, coming from a psychological perspective, is to look for ways to help people manage and support them in their ability to work with these difficult things. And also, my own background is in Buddhist practice too. I've been a Buddhist much longer than I've even studied psychology. I've been practicing meditation even before I trained to be a clinician. And I've had the opportunity to bring these two worlds together when I was doing my postgraduate at Sydney University, studying the work of mindfulness meditation, Buddhist-based meditation, and how it actually works, and how it works in particularly in the treatment of anxiety disorder. Now, if you know anything about anxiety, you know that stress is very closely related with anxiety. When you're stressed, you're often worried about something. You're worried that you can't cope. You're worried that something bad is going to happen. And then it gets tightened up, tension. You walk around like this. Right? You know this experience. I don't even need to say too much of it. But there's a lot of that happening in society in general. And also the pace of life at the moment is such that it develops that, it builds that more and more. So there's a need for us to start to look at bringing ways that are effective in the treatment or the management of stress. Of course, this is a talk that can go easily for 12 weeks. I can talk about stress itself just for a period of a 12-week course, 2 hours each week, and I'll still have new material to talk to you about. But what I'll try to do is to pick a few things, given that this is a more a Buddhist area. I want to pick the practices that have roots or influences from Buddhism and use that and try to weave together from that. Alright? Is that okay with people? Alright. So first of all, let's understand what stress is. Everyone talks about stress these days. And I even did some search. You know, Googling, you know, Wikipedia. Not the most academic sources, but just generally a sense of what is out there. What people mean by stress. And then there's a line that I really like. I think it was from Wikipedia. No one really agrees what stress is. Everyone talks about stress. You're stressed, I'm stressed, everyone's stressed. We understand what that means. But then when it comes to definition, what is it? And I remember that many years ago, I can't remember which particular setting, but I heard of someone give a very good definition of stress. And I'll share that with you. It's a formula. So you thought on Friday, finished with classes, but no, not yet. Anyone seen this formula before? Maybe you can't see too clearly. Huh? S equals PCH over PCO. That is stress. Thank you for coming. S, clearly. Initially when I wrote this this formula, I put this. Then I said, that's factorial. And I said, really? Stress is like factorial, you know, you just keep multiplying, multiplying, multiplying. It's so many times. So maybe just not to confuse and be mathematically complicated, let's go with it. PCH over PCO. What is PCH? Any guesses? Pressure of carbon plus some hydrogen components. Pressure from Chernobyl. Yeah, maybe not the best idea to use that. P is perceived. CH is challenge. The perceived amount of challenge that you're facing. And notice two keywords here. Firstly, challenge. That means a certain difficulty and this could be subjective. Something that's a challenge for you may not be something that's a challenge for you. Something that's a challenge for you may be something that's perfectly all right for someone else. It is a subjective sense. And the other thing is P. It's the perceived sense of challenge. If you think there is a challenge, it is a challenge for you. That's why sometimes when people say that they are stressed, they say, "What? You're all right. You can. You're fine." Does it help? No. It makes you more stressed. Right? But it's your perceived sense of challenge. Right? How about PCO? This one can't be me, right? What is PCO? Perceived control. Close?
Coping.
Control, coping, very similar. Your ability to face it. Again, perceived. Doesn't have to be real. Someone who thinks that they can do something. Oh, I don't need to study. Or A, chemistry, no problem. Carbon, hydrogen, a few letters will do. Are they stressed before exam? No. Are they stressed after exam? Maybe. Right? So it's a sense of perceived control or coping. So as you can see, if this increases, the greater the challenge, what happens to stress? Increase. If a greater sense of coping and control, let's say, what happens to stress? Decreases. See? Straightforward, right? Alright. So then, if we have this, where do we intervene then? Coping?
Yep.
One way is to increase this as much as we can.
Right.
The other one is to decrease this as much as it's practical and realistic for you. Sometimes if it can't work, then it can't work. Right? But then often this is a bit harder to shift. You have a challenge, it's easier to develop this. So it is in the internal development, this is the important part. We can wish that things are different. We can wish that challenges go away. But then something else pops up. Right? In fact, Buddhism says that this is part and parcel of humanity. That you will face challenges regardless of where you are, how you are, in what state you are in. In fact, as far as the Dharma is concerned, as far as the Buddha's teaching is concerned, this is a fundamental characteristic of life, that is a sense of something that is not quite right. That's the most subtle, to the point that you can't cope with the world. And that whole range of human experience is the underlying sense that all of us experience, regardless of who we are, what color, what background, what ethnicity. That's the fundamental sense. And that's why in Buddhist practice, a lot of the sense of the focus is in this. And this is where the Eightfold Path lies, the Noble Eightfold Path. That the cultivation of certain qualities of the mind allows you to work with these states and thereby reducing it. What is the meaning of liberation? It is the total eradication of stress. Right? But then you're like, whoa! I have to become monks or nuns, I have to go and stay at temples and monasteries. No, let's not go to that far. But I do want to talk about some of the actual principles that if not total full eradication, that actually helps us reduce stress. But even before we actually do that, let's know what stress actually does to us. Firstly, it changes us. You're not quite yourself when you're very stressed. You know this. Right? Emotionally, how are you? Are you like... Or are you... You know what I mean, right? If people smile, joyful, you're like, don't disturb me. Go away. Right? Emotionally, you're not there. You're very collapsed. There's no brightness, there's no lightness that's there. You're emotionally, not all that great. And you know, when someone is stressed, they walk into the room, avoid eye contact. Right? You feel that there's an aura, it's like there's an energy field. That's like... And can you connect well with people? You can't. Right? Relationally, things go wrong. Your family, your partner, your close friends, you know that when they're very stressed, it's hard to be around them. Right? You have to be quite strong, if not you also start getting stressed that they are stressed. They are stressed about something and you stress about them, and then you go home, someone else gets stressed about it, and then that's where the factorial comes. Cognitively, what happens? When I'm stressed, I notice that my mind is not clear. Usually I have my wallet and my phone in the car in a certain place. When I step out of my car, I will take my wallet and my phone and I'll put it in my pocket. So this is standard practice for me. And when I'm stressed, I'll come out of my car, assume that this is my phone, and I'll be like, where's my phone? Where's my phone? Can't find my phone. I've lost my phone and I've been holding it the whole time. But mentally you're not clear, cognitively. And when you talk about judgment, that's even worse. So when you're highly stressed, maybe kind of cool down a bit before you grab. Judgment-wise, you're not there. Right? You don't make very good decisions when you're really stressed. You know that. Right? The mind is not clear. There's no brightness. There's no sense of lightness in there. How about physically? You get aches and pains, you get tension, but you get heaviness in the chest. Sometimes people get heart attack because of stress. You always see those dramas. Some news happens and then the person... That's high level of stress. The perceived challenge shoots up to the roof. And coping is like, I can't cope with this, and then heart attack. Right? Even if it's not that bad, you know your heart goes poof, 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 poof. People ask me sometimes, you've given so many talks. In fact, the last time I came here at UNSW was a few months ago. I was giving a keynote address for a conference for anxiety practitioners. So all the clinicians who specialize in anxiety get together, and I was the keynote, one of the keynotes for the conference. And then people say, you give so many talks. Are you stressed? And then I just need to check. Yeah. Right? Physically, you're different as well. You tense up. Right? You're not so as at ease. Now, of course, the more that you develop this, the less that becomes. But you know that when you're in a stressful environment, physically you change. You get sick as well. Right? Immunosuppression. Your immune system is actually suppressed. Sometimes it's not suppressed in the process of going through the stressful period. But the moment that it's over, collapse. This we often find in postgraduate research students. If you have to do a thesis, any of you postgraduate research students here? We're all busy with the thesis. We can talk about that. I was one as well. When I was handing in my thesis, I was so busy in the last moment, and you finally hand it in, usually, I would say 9 out of 10 fall sick after. You hand in your thesis, yay! And then next day, cold, flu, right? Cannot wake up. Aches here, pains there, headache. Right? Usually it takes 1 or 2 weeks easily just to recover. And then your exam period, you know. Or your assignment period. I can, right? Overnight, all nighter, whoa, 12 hours work. Hand in the assignment, next day, missing in action. Immune system-wise, that gets suppressed. And you can only suppress the immune system for that long before there are repercussions. And when you actually have prolonged immunosuppression, that's when a lot of long-term type of difficulties arise. Can be very serious. Right, we have doctors here, they'll be able to tell you all about that. Right? So now that we know that stress creates all different types of havoc in our lives, and we know that it's not all that great, then the next question comes, and I guess why you're all here. The question is, what do we do? What do we do? And this is an important thing, because as much as education is out there, or in here even,
We often train people in knowledge, we train people in skills, we train people in ability. But what is often lacking is we do not train people in how to live a good life. Is that what it's like? You go and find out for yourself. There's a lack of knowledge in terms of how we live. That's why where I'm working now at Sydney University, we're trying to roll up programs to teach people just how to be. What's the quality of life? How do you emphasize well-being in your day-to-day life? And that's a knowledge that's often missing. And we know that from this point onwards, if you look at humanity as a whole, the ones that get really well and get ahead into the future, the way that we're evolving in the pattern, is no longer the one who has the most knowledge, not the one who has the most skill. It will come to a point where it evolves to those who know how to have a strong base. Because it's going to be a challenging, this is going to go up, it's going to be fast-paced. And those that can survive, survival of the fittest, the fittest ones are the people who are able to cope. So we have to arm ourselves and equip ourselves in our ability to work with these things. Let's go to Buddhism. What can it offer? When we look at what the entirety of the Buddha's teaching is, it is essentially equipping us to deal with daily life difficulties. In this life, that is the main key emphasis. Right? There are different strands of Buddhism that kind of evolve from there. But the earliest message that the Buddha had is this, that in life there is pain, there are difficulties. Don't shy away from it. Know it, learn it, understand it. Get up close to it and know clearly the experience that you have. That is the first noble truth. Any of you know the four noble truths? How many of you know the term the four noble truths? The four noble truths is essentially an encapsulation of the entirety of the Buddha's teaching. You can say that it's like a summary of the Buddha's teaching. Four different statements that he's given. And four truths that he has talked about humanity. Firstly, that in life there are times, there are suffering, there is pain, there is dis-ease, there is unsettledness. No, depending on which translation you go with. The Buddha says there is dukkha. Dukkha means, not the best translation, some sense of unease, unsettledness. Something's not quite right. And it says that the second truth is that the cause of dukkha, that is important for us to know. The third is that we understand the cause, we can remove the cause, and that is the falling away of dukkha. And the fourth part, the fourth noble truth is, this is the entire practice that he has given part by part, contained within that Noble Eightfold Path. This is the fourth part. So you can pretty much encapsulate all of the Buddha's teachings into these four sections. And in the first noble truth, he's saying that this is reality of life. Know it. Understand it. Get up close to it. Be intimately aware of what is the experience of suffering. It is only through that process that we can learn to know the cause of it. And as we learn to know the cause of it, then there is every possibility of uprooting. And if you want to know a specific way, a systematic training to do it, this is the normal way. So the entirety of the Buddha's teaching is never outside of us. It is not about something that happens after we die. It's not something that is kind of out there, supernatural, but it's very much closely in touch with our experience as humans. So you can say that the Buddha was a magnificent teacher. He's also an extremely powerful psychologist. He has known through his own experience and introspection the nature of experience. That's why when he gave his teaching and helping people to come out of pain and suffering,
a lot of these teachings are currently being used in mainstream psychology, helping professions, counseling, psychotherapy. And out of all of these types of transitions, or I sometimes call it the export of Buddhism into the health professional, one key thing that has kept getting more and more emphasis, more and more interest, is this thing called mindfulness. Now, anyone who has attended my talks before know that this is my key area of interest. If I can talk about stress for 12 weeks, I can talk about mindfulness for 12 years. All right. I know we finished at 9 o'clock. Mindfulness is essentially what we see as kind of the meditation that Buddhists do. That's probably, to most people, that's what they associate with. That 5-10 minutes that we did early on, that's a introductory, very brief touch as to what mindfulness is about. It's about cultivating the ability to direct our awareness towards the present manifesting body and mind. Okay, that's a lot of words. It's basically our ability to keep coming back to what's happening in the body, what's happening in the mind. What's happening in the body, what's happening in the mind. That's the ability. To be mindful means to hold in your mind, and to hold your mind what? The Buddha says, the reality of your body and the reality of your mind. What is happening now? Now what's this breathing? What's happening with the breathing? Oh, I'm thinking. Alright, I'm noticing I'm thinking. What's happening in the body? What else is happening? So this is a systematic training of attention and awareness. And this, since about the 1970s, has been brought more and more into the healing and health profession, and be found to be useful in all different types of settings, different types of disorders, different types of difficulties. Now, I won't go too much into that. I've actually covered that the last time I was here. But really, in the last 15 years, there's a huge exponential increase in the amount of research to do with Buddhist-based mindfulness practice. And in fact, one of my contributions, or one of my research, was actually contributed to that pool of research in mindfulness, especially in anxiety in that case. What they have found is that time and time again, if someone does meditation practice, mindfulness-based. There are kind of different types of meditation out there. But if you take specifically this mindfulness-based practice, they see that a lot of benefits start to appear. So they've done very systematic studies of all these different people, different groups that actually do this practice. And out of these few different key pieces of research, there are about three of them that struck my mind. And it's kind of always there. And when I look at the data, the research, I'm a scientist on one hand. I'm a clinician on the other hand. And I'm also a practicing Buddhist on another. So my scientist part of me is like, whoa, looking at the data, whoa, what's happening? What did they find? So I'm going to tell you a few of these key pieces of research. Firstly, I mentioned this one before. Year 2003. Richard Davidson's research published is based on University of Wisconsin. What he has done is that up to that point in the early 2000s, there's a lot of research in the 90s and so that look at people with pain, with different types of psychological difficulties, anxiety, depression, and so on and so forth. They found people with chronic pain, all different types of kind of difficulties, right? Different issues that people have. And they teach them systematically to do this mindfulness practice. And they found great results. Then someone asked, but then what about people who are not necessarily particularly depressed or anxious or having chronic pain or some form of physical problem? What about people like that? What about high-functioning people? Hopefully, like you and me. Alright. High-functioning, plus and minus, good days, bad days, depending on our stress levels. Okay. How about people like that? So I said, fine, let's do a community-based research. They went to a high-tech company, right? High-function people, high-tech company, people are, you know, very productive. And they say, all right, let's divide the company into two groups, randomly allocate people into two groups.
One group, we say, continue as you would normally. The other group, let's take them through an 8-week course. 8-week program, 2 hours each week, and then we see what changes there are in these people. So 8-week program of meditation. Okay. At the end of this 8 week, what they say is that it's a bit hard to see the differences between these two groups. We have to give them some measure, some form of a test. And they say that what would be the best test? They seem to be functioning okay. So psychological tests, they're all okay to begin with. After, you can't tell much of a difference. What about their immune system? There's something that maybe is interesting there. So what they've done is that, what's the best way to check your immune system? Something that's objective in order for us to test each individual's immune system. So they came up with a measurement, which is give everyone a flu vaccination. Any of you who knows vaccination, the essential principle is you get something that's quite nasty, like flu, for example. You take the very weak part of the bacteria or the virus or whatever it is, and then put it in your body. And when you put it in your body, the body then reacts. It builds up the antibody that's there. It fights it, it clears it, and therefore it already has the antibody ready for when the big ones come. This is essentially the principle of vaccination. Are we okay so far? Okay. I assume everyone has some form of vaccination. Well, let's hope so anyway. There are a few doctors here, so you can talk to them after. So essentially, they say, let's give everyone the same flu vaccination. So it's objective. Everyone gets. For example, this is the group that practices meditation. That's the group that doesn't. Let's give everyone flu vaccination. And let's measure how well their body fights that flu vaccination. That flu virus that's given. Right, that will be an objective measure. See how quickly they react, how quickly the body creates the antibody, how quickly it kind of pushes it up. Pretty good idea, right? I was like, oh, pretty good thinking. I was like, how do you measure? Maybe, you know, put them in a stressful, put them in a chamber or something, lock them out, see what happens. Maybe you can't get ethics approval for that. Or maybe flu vaccination is better. So what they found is that the group who didn't do practice, that's fine, general, normally this is what will happen, what we assume to happen. You got a flu virus, and then after a while, you recover from that. Right? For a few days, you may get a bit, not that great, but then very quickly you recover. How about this group with the meditation? The group with meditation actually created more antibody quicker. So their reaction to the flu vaccination was quicker, stronger. So they're able to clear the initial vaccination, the virus that was given, much quicker than the group. So this became the first early piece of evidence saying that immune-wise, immune system-wise, there's something about doing this meditation practice. In fact, the researchers were pretty surprised too, because they're not doing anything specific to the body. We're just asking you all to meditate. We're not asking you to go and get a massage, that's a bit more physical, give you supplements, vitamins, no. It's mental vitamin, but somehow that translates to the physical side. And from then, they're continuing to study, oh, this is interesting. Maybe there is more to this. And from that point onwards, evolved to different pieces of research. And in the more recent time, 2009, David Creswell's research. This was done in UCLA. What they did was, they say immune system, let's get a disease whereby the main emphasis or the main attack of the virus is on the immune system. What do you think they chose? HIV. Yep, correct. HIV. So they found people with HIV, people who are recently diagnosed with HIV, you're clearly quite distressed, right? This is like a lifelong thing. I don't know, I don't think they've really found the cure yet. They've kind of slowed it down a bit, the progression of that, but there's no real cure. So you have it, it's a matter of kind of continuing to deteriorate until you go into AIDS, and then eventually you die, right? It attacks your immune system that way, right? So what they did was that they look at individuals who are diagnosed with HIV, and out of these individuals, there are people who feel that they are more stressed, because this is a huge challenge, right? If you're diagnosed with HIV, this is a huge challenge. But different people cope differently. Some people find that, you know, it's all right, you just live with it. Some people get very stressed, oh goodness, I can't. So they found those who are diagnosed and have very high levels of stress, which essentially means their perceived sense of coping is quite low. These people are very psychologically distressed. So okay, they get this group of people who are particularly vulnerable, because they know that the more stressed it is, the worse it is for the body, and the quicker the progression in the body. If you know anything about HIV, you know that it's different from AIDS. Right? Someone who is HIV positive do not necessarily have AIDS yet. The definition is when your antibody or your T cell count drops. When you're diagnosed with HIV positive, your T cell starts to drop. High is good, low, it will drop to a certain cutoff point. When you drop below the certain point, I can't remember, 200 or 250, something like that. You drop to a certain point, then you're HIV positive. It continues to drop, then eventually death. So you know that the T cell counts usually have a gradual sense. So the lower it is, the more severe it is. So what they did was that they brought all this group of people with HIV positive, who were HIV positive, and then they randomly allocated them, just assuming all of you are the pool of subjects, right? Randomly allocate you to two groups, one group that you, group A, and then the other group, group B. Both HIV positive, no AIDS yet, but very distressed. Group A attends a one-day workshop that you talk about mindfulness. Just talk about it. This is the research, this is so great, 8 hours. Just talking about it. I don't know how you can talk about it without really practicing. But anyway, this is the group. You only talk about mindfulness. Whereas this group is a bit different. This group goes through an 8-week program, very similar. That you practice, you come together, you practice, you come together, you practice. So this is the control group, this is the treatment group. Okay? Got that so far? What they found was that after the entire program finished, there was a difference in the T cell count. You want to see what the graph looked like? If people walk past, they would think that this is a chemistry or maths class or something like that. Alright, let me rub off my own name. This is the T cell level. Yeah. And this is baseline. That means before any treatment. This is post treatment. They found that initially there was a bit of difference even within the group. Can't be helped. Sometimes with random allocation there's still a difference. The group A, this is the talk only group, had their levels, T cell levels there. Group B, this side, were the ones who actually did the mindfulness practice, engaged in it week after week with homework in between, go back home, you do your practice. There was some difference there. With group A, expected, right? At times, as time goes by, especially when this is a highly distressed group, you expect that the T cell counts actually drop. By how much? They found their group 25% drop, which is quite a fair bit, right? Not a good sign. What do you think happened to the T cell group?
Didn't drop much.
Maintain. Go up. Everything covered. So it kind of went out, yeah. Maintain. Just in case. Flat line. In this world, flat line means you gain. Flat line means like this already. You know what I mean? If everyone else is doing this, and you are having flat line, (laughs) 25% drop, and this one, no drop. It will be interesting to look if they do follow up the period after this to see how different. I think if these people continue their practice and these people don't, the gap will become larger. I will assume that, but I have to wait for the data to be able to say that. When I look at this, I was like, this is pretty amazing. Again, we are not doing anything to the body. And when the researchers look at this, it's like, hang on. Maybe this group is taking different medication to that group. Let's check their medication use. Right? And they took out the effect of medication. Statistically, they parcel that out. Take that out. Still the same. This is not, it doesn't matter what medication you take, it is irrespective of the medication. This is the effect of just the mental training itself. That's why the Buddha was correct. A large part of Buddhist practice is meditation. When you look at the Buddha, he is in the posture of meditation. Often you look at Buddha statues, where is he? Meditation. Look around, meditation. Right? Think of Buddha statue, meditating. It is a sign. You seldom see the Buddha talking, right? Checking the phone, reading newspaper. But that's the core of the practice. And there's actually a very powerful sense of this opening up, your coping opening up. The stress levels actually reduce. Remember, both groups have the same amount of challenge. And that is pretty amazing, that I think. One other piece of research. You guys want to hear about that? Yeah. This one is a bit different. It's not so much a sick population. But I always say, you know that some intervention or some program is really, really good when someone is interested. Who? When a certain party or certain organization is interested in a certain program, you know that the program is gaining some popularity. Which organization is it? Government? Yeah, close. It's related, something a bit more specific. Military. Not just any military. You heard of the US Marine? This was pre-deployment to Iraq. So I always say, if the military, especially the US military, is interested in some intervention, some program, you know that that program has got pretty steady ability. Right? Now, no matter how our personal or even the religious point of view as far as war is concerned, let's put that out the door right now. That's not the topic of discussion. But we know that sometimes army or military personnel has to be deployed in difficult situations. And in this case, it was Iraq. It wasn't that long ago. Let me check when was this published. 2010. So this was when the US had to deploy a lot of US Marines to Iraq for various reasons, right? And they had to continue there. And you know, what is the most stressful type of situation? When your life is at stake, this is the good. You go there, this is not just fighting a party that you can see. This is to do with a lot of any moment, even if you're off duty, your life can go just like that. Bombing, attacks, things like that. When you're on duty, it's hard enough.
You can be shot anytime. Things can blow up anytime. Stressful? I think so. Right? Even if you're off duty, that's still a very stressful environment. What they find is that no matter how well they train the troops in terms of their military skills, how well they prepare them, when they send these troops into a deployment into war, what they find is that after a while, if they're in there for long enough, what happens to them? Their cognitive ability that starts to wither. Like what I was saying earlier on, your judgment becomes not very good. Right? Emotionally, not all that great. You start to have a sense that, you know, imagine being anxious 24 hours, 24/7. That's why in the deployment of troops, very often there's a change over. Because it cannot be in there for too long. Right? It's inhumane in that sense. The stress level is too high. So they found that, okay, they were scanning all the research and they think, seems to be that these mindfulness people may have something. So they say, well, let's try it on our troops and see. They call it the mindfulness-based mind fitness training. Working with military, you kind of have to spice it up a bit. They went through this mindfulness-based mind fitness training for troops that were before being deployed to Iraq. Right? Fair enough, this is not a randomly allocated study. But they chose some groups, just put them into this entire company, entire platoon goes to do the mindfulness-based training. I think about 8 to 12 weeks, plus a one-day silent retreat. So that's quite fantastic. Military camp, everyone meditating in silence. Not exactly the scene that we would expect, but that was what they did. So they took the group whereby they give them training, right? Give them a silent retreat. And then another group whereby they are deployed to the same place in Iraq without training. And then they found a third group, let's say me, who are civilians, who are not being sent to Iraq. And they test their abilities across time. When they did this study, they also asked this group for practicing. How much are you practicing each day? Write it down, record it, and then send it back to you. I know some of you may be thinking, you're in the military camp. Did they say that you didn't practice? But no, they also thought of that. They say, okay, you don't tell your superiors how much you practice. This is completely anonymous. You write the amount of time you practice, you send it straight to the research lab at the university. The military doesn't know how much you actually practice. So they were actually quite truthful. This day, didn't practice. Today managed 2.5 minutes. Next day, 30 minutes. Right? It may fluctuate. So they looked at how much that they practiced each day as well. What they found was, within these three groups, during deployment, when they were there, the cognitive ability of this group, right, the group that did not do any meditation practice, they sent them to Iraq, memory, their judgment, all those things across time. Drop. You expect that. Right? In a high stress environment, you just don't think as clearly. So your cognitive abilities continue to drop. Whereas this group, they found that there's something different. Right, let's do the civilian group first. This group here. Civilians did not get sent to Iraq. When they tested them at time one, time two, not much different. Because they were not sent to a stressful environment, just as a control. But people's ability usually stay the same if they're not stressed. If someone is stressed, their ability drops. This group, however, is quite interesting. When they got there, every one of them seemed to be coping better, generally. But then after that, there's a bit of mixed results. Some do okay, some do not so okay. And then they began to ask, why? And then they looked back at their data. How much are they practicing each day? So they found that those who were practicing less than 10 minutes each day of meditation, when they got there, they are doing better than that group, but they have a decrease, but a slighter decrease compared to that group. So still going down, but not as quickly compared to that group. But the people who practice more than 10 minutes each day, the more that they practice, the cognitive ability stays pretty stable. Again, in a situation like that, life and death, you stay stable, that's what you do. If you are there in Iraq, which school would you want to be in? If you have someone that you had to watch your back, right? They usually go in teams. You got teams of people who help each other, watch each other's back. With your friends, which group do you hope they're in?
That team, because you get sent back.
That could be. Two ways to get sent back. On the top deck or the under deck. Right? You know what I mean. Right? I would more willing to go for this one.
Right? But you can see that the stressful environment, because of mindfulness meditation practice, it helps to manage them. Again, we're not specifically doing anything to this. We're not changing that at all in all of the cases that I spoke about. This remains the same for the different groups. But as this increases, we are creating a more ability to cope, mental abilities. This one drops. You're able to weather that much, much better.
So my advice to you is, if you can, practice. Practice meditation. Learn how to do it. Learn how to do it well. So that when you practice, you gain the best out of it. That is one part.
Right.
I won't go too much into that. Like I say, I can talk about this for a long time. But I want to change tack a bit into another thing that also comes from kind of a Buddhist influence, one of the teachings, that has been found to be useful to inoculate or to manage stress. What is it? The Buddha says there are two kinds of people that are hard to find in the world. This is in the Anguttara Nikaya. There are two types of people the Buddha says are difficult to find in the world. What are they? The first one is the first to do kindness. Right? They're always the first to show kindness. This type of people, very hard to find.
Or maybe you're here, maybe you're quite common here. A lot of kind people, that's great. Right? Usually people say, oh, you're Buddhist, oh, you must be very kind, very compassionate. Not necessarily the case, but maybe more so.
But the second type is what I'm more interested in. The Buddha says, the second type of people that is hard to find is those who are grateful and thankful for kindness that is done. We always usually emphasize the doing of kindness, but the other one who is equally as valuable are those who are thankful and grateful for whatever kindness that has been done to them. Right? And the Buddha in the Majjhima Nikaya says, a person with no integrity is ungrateful and unthankful. Ingratitude is advocated by rude people, people with no integrity. Essentially saying, if you have no integrity, that's why you're not grateful. If you're not grateful, pretty much not very good people. The Buddha then says, a person with integrity is grateful and thankful. Gratitude is advocated by civil people and people with integrity. So the Buddha has always emphasized the gratitude and the thankfulness in our day-to-day life. That is an important quality for us. And I sometimes find that this is not something that we often draw our mind to. Gratitude, thankfulness. Sometimes even within Buddhist circles, we do a lot of emphasis on practicing kindness and compassion, which is important. I'm not saying that that is not. But I think it's more important for us to also develop this other quality of being thankful and having gratitude. So this, you can see, is an important part of Buddhist practice. And again, things like gratitude has also started to creep into psychology. I'm a scientist, so I like to look at research. What they found is in 2003, there's a research paper published by a team in University of California, Davis. A good friend of mine is currently working there. This is a kind of a very forward-thinking, very progressive part of university. So they are studying different types of interventions and how it affects people. And they say, why not we study gratitude? Let's see when people have gratitude, what happens to them? Very good research question. So they did three studies. The first study was, they got a bunch of people, And for a 10-week period, they say every week,
I want to give you,
just to double check,
for 10 weeks every week, I want you to write something at the end of the week. I'm going to divide you into three groups. Group 1, Group 2, and Group 3. Group 1, every time at the end of the week, I want you to write all the hassles of the week. This didn't go right, this went wrong, this one was no good, this was a hassles group.
The second group was
the neutral group. Okay, that's right, whatever happened, this happened, that happened, neutral, right? Factual, descriptive. And the third group, they say, this group, write about everything you're grateful for in the week. Right? Just write that, as much as possible. Right? Just write. 10 weeks, 10 pieces of assignment.
What they found was that after 10 weeks, they looked at comparison. They found that the group was writing a lot of gratitude, thankfulness. They found that they felt better about life. Surprise, surprise. Right? They're emphasizing, focusing on that, you feel better about life. And then they were more optimistic compared to the other two groups.
Not surprising, yeah?
What is surprising even to the researchers? This group was more likely to exercise. I don't know what that means. The researchers also say they don't know why that is the case. But this group somehow was exercising more when they were asked to do gratitude. Maybe they feel that life is given to me, I should be out there moving. I don't know. But we know exercise is good, so it's a good thing. Right? So compared to the all three groups, this group was doing the best.
This group here, one that's running the hassles, the worst. This was the worst, this one so-so, that one was the best.
So say, let's repeat this this experiment again. This time, we use a shorter period. Instead of 10 weeks, we shorten it to 2 weeks, but let's do it daily. Daily writing down. Oh, all these people think, oh, more assignments. All right, the participants were okay with it, they had consent. So this time, the same thing.
Let's swap this around, not related to this group. So this group writes about gratitude daily. This group writes about neutral things every day. And this group writes about hassle. Oh, this went wrong, that went wrong.
What they found was that the group which was writing about gratitude each day for 2 weeks, they have greater sense of positive effect, means positive emotions, joy, happiness, contentment. That naturally came up. Just asking them to write every day compared to this group, and again, the hassle group was always the worst. And also what they found was that this group who was writing daily about gratitude, they were not just grateful about receiving. They were also more likely than the other two groups to be helping people. Because when you can be gratitude, we can be thankful for the kindness that's been given to you in life, then you're more ready to offer kindness to others. You cannot give from an empty tank. Right? If your car drive, there's no petrol, how are you going to move? So the same thing, gratitude is almost like a fuel for you. As you bring your awareness and your attention to that which you're grateful for, that allows you to then be a much stronger sense to be offering kindness towards other people. And that's what they found. And this is quite interesting, quite amazing. And then they say, alright, maybe these are normal people. Maybe it won't work for people who are kind of highly distressed. So they say, let's run a third experiment. This time, they look for people with neuromuscular disease. Neuromuscular disease come in all different forms, but essentially it's highly distressing. Very often it's painful. People like that have kind of, usually, very often you see anxiety, stress, depression as well. They don't sleep well because of often the discomfort that's associated with the illness and the disease. So they say, let's look at people with neuromuscular disease and see what happens. So This was, they recruited these people, randomly allocated them to two groups. This time they did 3 weeks daily. But I think they could not get through ethics, a three-group condition. They had to drop one group. You know why? Which group do you think they dropped? The Hassles group. Right? Because results already show that the more you focus on the Hassles, not good. So these people are already in pain. You want them to focus on hassle? Anything happens, the researchers cannot be responsible. So, alright, better not. Just gratitude versus neutral. Two group conditions. So after 3 weeks, daily writing about neutral or something to do with the gratitude, what they found was that people who were writing about the thankfulness and the gratitude had increased levels of positive affect, right? Feeling more positive sense. Had reduced negative effect, right? The pain, the depression, the anxiety, all those, compared to that group, is much less, significantly less. What they also found is that this group increased the amount and the quality of sleep. They're sleeping better, they're sleeping more. Again, we're not giving them still notes or anything like that, we're not giving them sleeping pills, we're just asking them, write down what you're grateful for to sleep better. You sleep more. So you have difficulty sleeping, you know what to do now. Right? It's a mental supplement that's 100% safe and proven to be very effective. You just have to do it for daily for 3 weeks. And then they say, maybe these are people who feel that they have to report something. Maybe it's just all in their head. Maybe really they're not experiencing anything that's different. It's all just self-reporting. So they say, alright, this group, you ask each individual to nominate the carer or the partner or the husband, their wife, or the close, someone who is close to them, who knows them well, who spent a lot of time with them, and we interview those people. What do you notice about them? Do you notice any changes in them? So this is based on not just the self-reporting, but information from the partner. They also reported a significant increase in well-being. They notice that these people seem happier. Right? Otherwise, within these 3 weeks, based on just doing the exercise, they seem a bit brighter. Don't complain as much. Right? They seem a bit lighter. And this is actually very useful to know. That it is not just an internal transformation. That this transformation is actually influencing how one is relating externally. And you can see, we are turning over the effects of stress. Again, both of them, same. Both neuromuscular disease. Right? But the sense of change is here. In what you focus on. What you put your mind onto. One put your mind onto something that is neutral. The other one put on something specific that you are thankful for. And just by doing that, the stress levels decrease significantly between the two groups. And as we were thinking about why this was the case, I came across a piece of research. This was in 1996, whereby this is a psychology research. And the research advertisement says, we want to recruit people for memory study. Some of you may have done those psychology research. How many of you have done psychology research participation? Okay, a few of them victimized, yes. I was there too. So they advertise, this is a memory research. You come in, we give you a list of words to remember, and then after that we test you how much you remember. Fair enough, straightforward enough. But this is an experiment within an experiment. With psychology research, sometimes they don't tell you what they're really testing until after. What they do is they randomly allocate all the people who are coming in to two groups. But the task is exactly the same, but the only difference is the list is different. One group has what we call positive word list, the other group has negative word list. So this group, remember, words like peaceful, patient, cooperative, unhurried. This group, you have a negative word group. You have words like aggressive, impatient,
intrusive, racing. They didn't even tell them that there's any difference. It's hard to remember these words, we're just testing your recall. That's all. Right? So what they did was, after the experiment, they say, you're required to go to the research assistant to get your thing signed so that you can make sure that you've already done this research and give any reimbursement if you need to. Right? So the task is set up that you've done your recall and everything. All right, you pack up. I'm the research assistant. So this is my office. And then you will come to me to get my signature. Fair enough. That's kind of just a procedure. They don't know that that's still part of the research. Right? They think, just go and get the signature. Whereas I'm in my office with the secretary of the lab, and we're just chatting. Right? And we're just chatting with each other. And in fact, the secretary is telling me about all the different difficult things that about their personal problems. This person is complaining, my life, and then my husband, and then my wife drove the car, and I was like, and then you are coming here with your sign-up sheet, you're just waiting for the time to get the signature. What they measure is how long the person waited. Very smart, right? These psychologists, I tell you. They found that the group with negative words became impatient. Come on. Hello? Can I get interrupted quicker? So what we call response latency. It's lower. That means they tend to interrupt quicker. This group, however, just waited. Right? And then I will still be chatting. It went up to the maximum amount of time because they had to stop at some point. These people were still waiting. So I had to see, already 6 minutes. Okay, all right. A lot of these people actually waited out the entire period. In a way, it's not surprising. But what is the surprising part about this research is, afterwards, when they ask each of these people, why did you interfere? Or why did you wait longer? Right? Or why didn't you interfere? Why didn't you kind of say hello? Or what made you kind of interfere? They were unable to explain why. They said, of course I just did. These people said, yeah, of course I just interrupted because I need to. These people said, yeah, of course I waited because I need to. They were not able to explain what was it that caused them to act in their way. But the experimenters know that these two groups are exactly the same. The only difference is the list of the words. So you can see the power of what you're focusing on. If you're constantly focusing on things that are kind of, you know what I mean? I don't need to tell you the content. That sense of, right? That's what you're walking around with. If you're focusing on things that are clear, brighter, things that you're grateful for, things that are of kindness, compassion, then the way they interact with the world totally changes. Again, we're not changing PCH there. We're manipulating PCO. And by doing that, stress goes down. Yeah? Is it just me or is this interesting? Sometimes I think that I'm just nerdy. You know? I just like things like that. More of that. Alright. Now, in Buddhism, we often talk about impressions. This is very much the thing. Impressions. The analogy is like there's a line that's been drawn. That's like an impression that you have in your mind. There are three types of line that are drawn. One is a line that is drawn on water. If you try to draw a line on water, the moment you draw it, the moment it disappears. But if you do that long enough, it's like a line drawn on sand, on a sandy beach. It stays, but then when the tide comes in and it goes, it disappears. And then if you do something continuously over and over again, it becomes like a line drawn on rock with a chisel and a hammer. And you can see, this is how we create habits. This is how we create the way that we interact with the world. And very often, even in my clinical work, when I sit in front of a patient or a client,
a lot of times is to get them to change the way that they interface with life. Because very often, I can't change this, but I can change the perceived sense of the challenge, and I can increase this. Very often, it's not about changing this. Sometimes you can. When there's a certain conflict, okay, let's work out how do you resolve this conflict. But very often, it's changing how we perceive it and how we're dealing with it, how we're coping with it. And the way that we do things over and over again creates impressions. And this is important. So it is in how you live, whether you live mindfully, whether you live with compassion, whether you live with kindness, whether you live with gratitude, each moment, each attention that you bring on to that moment, that part of a mind state, that creates an impression, that creates an impression, that creates an impression. And things that you do over and over again creates a strong sense of impression. It becomes habit. It becomes how you are. It becomes a part and parcel of your mental persona or your mental DNA, your personality. So it's important for us to know how to live our life so that we can start changing. Be aware of how we are interacting with our life, internally and externally. And talk is one thing. Doing is another. So it's quite important for us to learn to do this. And what best time to practice than now? You've had the 10 minutes practicing of mindfulness before we started this evening, so we won't go there. But is it alright as a group that we learn to practice regularly? Is that alright with you? So that we can start leaving some stuff in the impressions of gratitude. Is that alright? Okay. What I just get you to do is just in your own time, in your own mind, you don't even need to write this down. Just think of 5 things that you're grateful for just today. Don't need to look too far back, too far in the future. Just today, 5 things that you're grateful for. And if you're more kind of a physical person, I can suggest that you use your right hand. You raise your right hand. Actually, raise your right hand. Right? Most of us have 5 fingers. Right? What you do is, you think 5 things. 1 thing. 5. Think of the 5 things and then you put it in your heart. Okay? This makes it even more real, more physical. Right? Thinking of it, you kind of feel it. After that you forget. But this, you create a sense of, right? Put these things, think of the 5 things and put it in your heart. Right? Take 45 seconds and think of these 5. If you've already come up with this 5, go into it and feel it. It's not just that. It's kind of no feeling. Once you've decided, just go back and kind of feel it, that one. Pause with it, right? So take 30 seconds or 45 seconds to do that. If you got more, you can use the other hand too. If you got even more, use your legs as well. Yeah. Got so much, I had to go and borrow some hands. Okay, everyone done? Put it in your heart. Feel it. 5 things. Just today. 5 things. Imagine if you do this every day. What changes it will make. Not just to yourself, but to the people around you. Can I take this just one level more? Is that alright with people? Okay. One thing is to have it in here. The other thing is to be able to articulate it. What I get you to do is, each of you, when I say go, just find a partner. Just identify, pair up, okay? Actually, find a partner. If you don't have a partner, put your hands up and look around and you'll see that someone else has their hand up, partner. You can move, right, this one. Find a partner. You're meant to kind of talk and make eye contact at this point. If you don't have a partner, put your hands up. Everyone has got one? Okay, identify who is partner A, who is partner B. Partner A, raise your hand. Partner B, raise your hand. Okay, so there's no confusion this way, right? I'm going to give you each 30 seconds when I say go. When I say go, I want partner A to tell partner B what are the 5 things that they have. Okay? Just tell them and, right? This is partner A's job. Partner B, just listen attentively. Because you are being a witness of someone's life. This is important. This is receiving. That is the practice of gratitude and thankfulness in itself. I know some of you are already thinking, I need to censor that one I cannot say. If you need to censor, censor. But you don't need to, right? Partner B will just listen. If partner A has already finished, right? Just sit there quietly, and then I'll bring the bell, then we'll swap over. Then partner B then says, what are the 5 things? Oh, B, you thought you could get away, right? And then this time, partner A listens attentively. Alright? Sometimes when I practice in the Buddhist circle, what I found that it's useful is the person who is listening just has their palms together. Just as a sign of, I'm hearing you, I'm respecting that this is your life, and I know that this is a privilege. But if this is not for you, this is not for you, that's fine. Alright? But the one who listens, you don't need to say anything, you just listen, you just bear with it. If there's anything you want to say in the end to the other person, you can, but you don't necessarily need to. Is that clear? Alright? So partner A will start by telling, partner B will listen. You have 30 seconds, partner A, please begin. If you haven't finished, finish up. Thank your partners for sharing each other's life. How was it for people doing that? How was it saying it? How was it hearing it?
Gratifying.
Which part? When you're saying it or when you're hearing? Warm feeling. Very hot. So next time you're waiting for bus in the cold.
Okay,
maybe you take out your SMS. Darling, I love you. But yeah, usually there's sometimes people have report a sense of warmth. A sense of like, it's just almost being cared for. I know someone put a blanket on you and say that, it's all good. Yeah. Great. What else? Okay. So kind of feeling a sense of connection with this individual. Some of you don't even know each other when you pair up, right? But you're listening to something that's quite real. Actually, it's very real for this person. How many of you felt that you kind of got a sense of connection to this person as you're doing that?
You don't need to put out your hand and look at the partner.
From how I was seeing it from here, you know, it's getting a bit late, and the heater is quite heated up, so I'm getting a bit drowsy. And as they do this exercise, I think, yeah. Huh? I have to tell people? Who said okay? But then as you're doing that, there's a...
Right.
Yeah. If I could put a video camera here, I've done this with other groups as well. The sense, the energy in you, it changes. It's almost brightening up. Forget about SK2, you know, like a sense of brightness. But you feel it, right? You feel it here. Right? And like I say, imagine doing this each day, 7 days, 7 weeks, 7 months. 7 years of your life. If that little bit could change you in that moment, then you're leaving the impressions there of that. Imagine if you keep doing this, how it will change for you. How many of you found that it was a bit difficult to find the five things? It's okay. How many of you found it was a bit difficult? I found it was difficult when I started. It was like squeezing the last part out of the toothpaste, you know? When you finish using the toothpaste, yes, I have to lean like that, trying to squeeze it out. But then the more you squeeze, the easier it becomes. This is not something that the more you squeeze, the less it is. The more you squeeze, the easier it is. Right? It's just something that you have to create. Right? How many of you find it difficult or a bit embarrassing or shy to be sharing that? Same thing. It's like, it's my life. Ooh. This whole gratitude thing, I don't know. But when you're able to express it and put it out there, the energy and the impressions that you leave in your mind, that's stronger. There's something a bit more solid about that. There's a sense of a witness that you have. So with people around you, if it's right, some people use Facebook. I put on five things, whoa, 1,000 people see, like. But when you put it out, what's that? When you put it out there, it's a stronger sense. And if each of us can do that little part, and people read it and then feel connected that way, imagine how we can start changing things. Right? Stress is just a small part in our life. When we're able to open up our hearts and our minds and learn to hold this and learn to navigate the world this way, then we become so much stronger. So much more powerful in our ability to work in different states that is in life. Really, to summarize and to put everything in context, stress is the part and parcel of our life, whether you like it or not, especially in the modern day when things are so fast paced. It is not an option. It's pretty much a nature of the current state that we're in. Right? We've looked through the different types of difficulty and the different type of damage they can do to us if we're not careful. We're not knowing the ways to cope with it. And hopefully, you know, with tonight's material, it's given you a sense of motivation and inspiration to kind of do a bit more. Right? To kind of develop the things that you need to do. You know, perhaps go and learn to do a bit more mindfulness, meditation, things like that. To even at least bring gratitude to your life. There's in fact a different list of different 8 things that I haven't even covered yet. Right? But if you can take away something, it is that there is something that we need to do. We need to bring our hearts towards in the right way, in the right direction, to create the right power of heaven, to create the right power of saints, so that we're able to weather the things that come in our way. And when we won't look even much deeper, right, we're just touching the surface of what the Dharma is about. Right? Today, my topic is more towards the psychology side of things. But we even look much deeper about what the Buddha's message is. He's saying that this, no matter 2,600 years ago and now, into the future, in the past, that's just the sense of humanity. That we're all at some point, or actually, if you look deeper into reality, constantly there's some sense of unease, some sense of things are not right. And it's subtle, but it's huge. And he's inviting us through his teaching to say, learn to look at it, learn to know it, learn to understand what pain, difficulty, suffering, stress is about. And when we can learn to look at that, we start to understand what the cause is. And when we know the cause, we know how to leave, come out of it. And when we know how to do that, then that is a really a life that's well lived. And he says that if you find that you're in darkness, you don't know how to proceed with this, look to the path that has given you, the Eightfold Path, the three trainings, the basic training of morality, the training of mental cultivation, and the training of wisdom. If you can master all these eight parts of it, then your life will be so much better. It will not be just a matter of reducing stress, but ultimately the total eradication. If you have questions,
does it have to be meaningful questions? Can it be trivial questions?
Yeah, as long as it's a question. Normally I charge for consultation.